You're listening to Humboldt Holding Up, brought to you by Los Bagels, bringing the community fresh baked bagels, of course, and my personal favorite, the famous slug. Los Bagels, they're here, baking through it 7 days a week at 403 2nd Street in Eureka and 1061 I Street in Arcata, or visit losbagels.com.
It's Humboldt Holding Up, the podcast that just keeps on going. Just
like the pandemic. Whether we like it or not.
We like it or not. Brought to you by the COVID-19 pandemic, this podcast that similarly is still here. I'm Stephanie McGeary.
And I'm Andrew Goff. A little bit of housekeeping before we get into this week's interview. Just a reminder that we are available on iTunes. So if you go and subscribe, you'll have these interviews show up right in your little podcast app. And you can scroll through all of our previous guests, scroll through the names of people in Humboldt who maybe you know or maybe you've heard of, and you're like, who's that person? It's kind of like a Rolodex of getting to know people in Humboldt without having to buy them dinner.
Exactly.
And then also, as always, we remind you that if you are a person who has advertising dollars as a part of your life, we are always looking for sponsors. You can put a commercial somewhere on this podcast, put that directly into the ears and brain of the Humboldt news consuming podcast listening populace.
This week, we are going to talk to Nezzy Wade, president of the Affordable Homeless Housing Alternatives, or AHA, as most people probably know it. We're going to talk about the recent camping ordinance that was passed by the Eureka City Council, as well as how the pandemic has affected this population and the other great work that this nonprofit has been doing.
Yeah, Nezzy has been a homeless advocate even preceding her work with AHA. She just has an immense heart for that community. So we're excited to talk to her. So let's get her in here, Nezzy. Hi, Nezzy.
I just walked in my door. It was so crazy. I don't know. I probably don't have the best view here either.
No, you have nice houseplants.
I have a lot of houseplants. Yes.
It's your first podcast? Well, first podcast that you've been on?
Yeah, probably.
Oh,
probably.
All right. That's good. I like it. So low expectations on our part. Then that's good.
I have no expectations, so it's good.
Yeah, great. Well, thank
you're good
you.
To go.
Yes. All right. Thank you again so much for joining us. I kind of just wanted to start out with like a fun little anecdote because this was sort of a first for me, our podcast guest. So last night, my toddler Ziggy, she often finds and plays with my phone, you know, and last night I was getting dinner ready and I heard a little faint voice just like, hello, hello, and then realized she had my phone and that she had called you, Nezzy.
Yes, she did.
That was just, she calls, you know, her grandma, her dad, you know, sometimes even Andrew or my coworkers, but I don't think she's ever called any of my other work contacts before.
Well, she reached a good source.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm fond of children.
Did you have a good chat with Ziggy?
Actually, I think Ziggy probably tired of it very quickly. And then it was like, hello, hello, hello. Is this a butt dial?
That was exactly what I heard. All of a sudden I heard, is this a butt dial? And then I picked up like, oh, well, not exactly. It was my toddler. So thank you so much for being understanding on that. But I thought
no worries.
That was cute and fun. But we'll move on from that to talking more about you. You know, I think a lot of people in our community probably know who you are and at least seen your name a lot. You've been in many of our articles about homelessness and programs available to them. And you come out to, well, I guess now virtually for the most part to a lot of local meetings to advocate for those experiencing homelessness. It definitely seems clear that you have a lot of passion for this work. We thought maybe you could just start by telling us, you know, a bit about yourself, you know, where you're from and what led you, you know, to working with this population.
Well, I'm from Bakersfield, California. My dad was a farmer. His dad was a farmer. They farmed together and they died within 1 month of each other when I was about 2 years old. So my mother and my grandmother took over the partnership. It was a whole family affair. A couple of my uncles stepped in and took over farming. And I had large families of Irish Catholic relatives, 10, 12 children in each family. We only had three in ours. My dad died very young, but my mom remarried. I got another brother out of that. And I lived in Bakersfield until I was 19, and then I got married very early and moved away to San Jose and lived in the Bay Area for about 10 years. And I went to college with my husband, and we got our degrees from San Jose State. And we traveled some. We relocated to Connecticut for a period of time, came back to the West Coast. It was a very important and significant experience to live on the East Coast. It was important to see that and the difference in lifestyles. I thought I had learned a lot about social class and inequality, and I learned a great deal more having lived on the East Coast. So coming back, I started teaching right away. And my whole career, adult career, has been in teaching primarily sociology, psychology, women's studies, biofeedback, general studies. I taught philosophy, a lot of different subjects because it was possible to do during that period of time. I think I'm a generalist, and that's made it possible for me to think big in terms of applications. And so it's led me through 40 years of teaching and on to retiring 14 years ago and 6 years ago, starting a nonprofit to do this work.
Wow. I'm curious, you mentioned a difference between the inequality that you witnessed between the West and East Coast. I'm curious as to what that was.
Well, first of all, frame that by growing up in Bakersfield on a farm.
Okay.
And although I lived in San Jose, and that was a commuter school, very much city life, and I lived in probably six different apartments in the time that I lived there, it was shocking to me because when we moved to a suburb of Stamford, Connecticut, which was a bedroom community for New York, and people commuted into New York City on the train, as my husband did. And I sort of rambled around in those parts for a while and discovered Westchester County and Rye, New York, and amazing wealth of things I'd never really seen, with gatehouses and servant houses and boat houses and main houses. And it was impressive to me. I'd been in a lot of land, but I'd never seen land that had been preserved for the wealth of a particular dynasty, so to speak, or royalty, so to speak. Yeah. That was the closest thing to aristocracy I saw in this country. Yeah.
And so then how did you end up in Humboldt?
I was living in the Bay Area and I was married at the time. And I loved the community I lived in. We were very involved in a lot of things because we lived in the center city, two blocks from the police department, city hall, and 40% of the area were renters. So we had worked with our landlords in the city to get rent rebates given to us to fix up the properties. And we had a skills exchange out of my garage, and we all had fruit trees, so we would compile all the fruit in one spot, and we were just about ready to purchase a ball mason canning operation when all the federal money dried up for community development. And it was, it just changed. The whole world changed. And that was back in the Reagan-Nixon era, and it was just really unfortunate that happened. But I, living close to the police department, lived in a little corner house, and my car was run into by a policeman driving at high speed about 10 feet from my bedroom window. And I just said, you know what? I can't do city life anymore. I just can't. I have to leave.
So what year was it that you landed in Humboldt?
78.
Okay. And I mean, AHA, I think, am I right in saying 2015? Is that when AHA was founded?
We started organizing when the Occupy movement was happening.
Yeah.
We were doing celebrations of determination at the courthouse when the Occupy movement was going on. And after that, we realized that it became the public face of homelessness, became the public face of Occupy. And so people did not have what they needed. There weren't street outreach, wasn't happening. We had no things like the MIST team. We had no services for folks, really. And they didn't have any place to go when the Occupy movement was chill.
Because I was going to say, I remember you working with local homeless population before AHA.
Yes.
And now that you've mentioned the Occupy thing, I remember that was all kind of wrapped up together. So how?
And there was an interim organization in there called Communities for Peace, which was kind of, this was all the anti-war. We had big, do you remember the big peace marches we organized?
Yeah.
5,000 people in Eureka coming to a peace march. We believed we were going to stop the Iraq war. They had so much compassion and engagement. As you know, that didn't happen. But there were a lot of people who were all part of the 99% that were part of that, that moved into an organization called Communities for Peace that was part of what came out of what are the next steps after those big peace marches? What do we do now? And so Communities for Peace did a lot of really good work, and they, members of that group, when Occupy happened, myself, Jim Paquin, who was a co-founder of AHA, and some others, decided to be support Eureka Occupy group, helping with food, helping with whatever was needed so people could continue to stay on site.
And yeah, we're coming up on 10 years since the Eureka Occupy.
I know. And that was a really interesting time because the sentiments were so strong. There was a small group in Fortuna that were doing an Occupy, standing in space. We had Eureka, there was HSU, there was Arcata. There were different groups, and they tried to coalesce all of those, but it was not successful in coalescing all those groups. So we decided we would just stick with the groups that we knew we needed a lot of help, and there were an awful lot of folks without housing that were coming to the site because it was inclusive and it was safe.
Yeah. So your activist work culminates in 2015. You guys found AHA. And for those not familiar, I'm sure you have this speech well rehearsed at this point. Could you just give an overview of what AHA sees its role being and what you're trying to accomplish?
When we were, as an outgrowth, we started going to public meetings, to the Housing and Homeless Coalition, to all the different groups that work around homelessness, and said what we're doing is not working. And we, some of the advocates had gone up to Oregon and checked out Opportunity Village in Eugene, Oregon, which seemed like such a simple, affordable response to homelessness. And we brought that idea back here and tried to start implementing it. We held a public forum and 250 people showed up. We had food and Andrew Heben came to speak. He's the co-founder of Opportunity Village and an urban planner. And he gave a great presentation. You can still watch it on Access Humboldt. In fact, we were thinking about doing a redo of the introduction and showing it again because it's so timely. And now that we've worked so hard to get some of these ideas into the housing element, now is the perfect time to begin implementing some affordable alternatives because we simply do not have housing. And it's very clear there's a big disconnect. The big disconnect is our definition of housing and the monies that go to support housing have a brick and mortar definition that involves infrastructure and all the building codes and all of those kinds of things for the most part. And so we could have billions and billions and billions of dollars available for rental assistance and that kind of stuff. But if we can't use it on developing or supporting housing that is non-traditional of the sort that we're talking about, then it's really hard. That's the disconnect because we have a lot of people that fall through the gaps. While they might apply for, they might be eligible for some housing programs, we don't have housing. And the ones that are eligible can possibly get into housing, but there's this huge number of people that fall into a gap that are chronically homeless for whom there's nothing. And we can't do camps and we can't do safe parking and we can't do tiny house villages, which would be a good way to stabilize people and begin developing community. That's what people want.
Yeah, you talk about that huge number of people. I think the first time I remember AHA really becoming a big part of the conversation around homelessness in Eureka and Humboldt was back in 2016 when the city of Eureka made the decision to evict the hundreds of people who gathered along the waterfront in the Palco Marsh, which some people call Devil's Playground. That was a big, swift change in a lot of people's lives. That's been 5 years ago now since that all went down. How do you feel that decision to evict has played out? Like what can we as a community learn from that event?
Have you got a lot of time? I'll try to
we have, yeah, that's what this is all about.
I'll try to do it succinctly because the reality is that that was that big encampment wasn't spontaneous. It amassed over time, and it amassed sure. because basically police gave the option, you know, you can go to jail or you can go to the Palco Marsh when they found people that were, you know, camping or whatever, or sleeping under the eaves. And some people didn't really want to go there, but it was a place that they could go and be out of the fray, so to speak, until such time as they wouldn't allow them to be there anymore. And it was a very planned thing in the way that it happened. People were concentrated in that area. Then the concentration, quote unquote, made it easier to get to the bad people. And the north end of the encampment was folded in. This was called incremental enforcement. The north end was folded in on top of the middle. The south end was folded in on top of the middle. A due date was picked. You're going to be out of here by May 3rd or May 2nd. And the able-bodied people who could move on and go someplace else, left early on. But there were still about 200 people that were left at the Palco Marsh that had no place to go. And it was the saddest diaspora I've ever seen, because people and their possessions and their animals were pushed literally to the streets. And the fallout from that is all of the things that we've seen, and the ordinances and the everything that's been passed. There's been probably 10 or 12 ordinances that have been passed trying to manage our response to that experience since then.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you think that was a mistake then to do it as it was done? Because it was kind of an intense situation over there, and I don't know that it could have gone on forever.
Well, it was, and it needed to change. Absolutely. And the people who lived there would say that it needed to change, a lot of them. It's just the difference between doing it from a command center with the police in the situation and that approach, as opposed to bringing people together and talking about what else could work. There was not an alternative. We tried, Andy Mills wanted to put, at one point, he was the police chief, people into a same size camp someplace else, which would have just lifted that up and moved it someplace else. And we discussed doing smaller camps of 25 people here or there. They just said they couldn't find those options. There was no land. And in fact, they still claim they have no land on which to do some of this. And land is the big issue. No matter where you get, you know, if you're a private property owner and your land is just sitting there, consider allowing a nonprofit like us to use that at a low cost to be able to do a transitional opportunity for people to move out of houselessness or out of wherever they are into someplace they can become stable and vest in community. Most people want to have someplace. And for people who just want to live outside, they shouldn't be able to just live outside. As long as they're, you know, not making trouble for other people, it would be great. And, you know, that's, everything is complaint driven.
Well, talking about, that and some of the ordinances that have come since, you know, in response to that, there was another camping ordinance passed by the Eureka City Council recently, and that essentially, you know, prohibits camping anywhere during daylight hours, and then anytime in some of Eureka's high profile business districts, in city parks and near trails. And the city has held that the ordinance replaces a more restrictive one, that this one is less restrictive, that it's kind of technically illegal to camp anywhere right now, and this actually gives more options and brings the city into compliance with current case laws. But I know that you've attended the meetings and you were really urging the council not to adopt this ordinance. I thought, you know, maybe you could talk a little bit about why.
Well, there are some really specific and very important reasons why. One, in the law, it says if you are living outside, that's illegal. That is just illegal. And so it doesn't have, you know, it has all those other things that go along with it too that you described. But it's going to keep, so if you can imagine from Indianola in the business area out there to Jacobs Avenue north of Eureka and all that area out there, and Target and all the area of business all along the coast, all the way down to, you know, the end of Eureka, essentially, and all of the business districts in Eureka and Henderson Center and the business districts in Myrtletown and the parks and the zoo and the golf courses and all the little parklets. That's a lot of space that a significant population is not being allowed to be in. They that means that's going to push them more to the margins than they already are. There's nothing specific in the law that says where people can go, and they're reluctant to say that, because they say in their experience it's resulted in encampments, which then become unmanageable because there's no security, there's no sanitation, and all those things. But there's never been the interest of creating with any kind of entity, you know, in collaboration with the folks that are out there, some other option. So it will keep people who have disabilities and find it harder to get around from being able to get to essential services and those kinds of things. That's the big concern. And it's further restricted in that it involves personal property as well. So if somebody wants to allow somebody to camp on their property, they have to be 51% owner of the property minimum. And it's still not legal to do that, but if they give permissions, if there's any problem, it's still a violation of the law. Like if it's too noisy or somebody complains.
Well, right. And like you said, you know, complaint driven, right, is how like the these things are against the law. But the idea, you know, the city has also really made it clear that that this isn't meant to be punitive, like that they're not going to try to enforce it much unless there is some kind of complaint, it seems like somebody is being a nuisance. I mean, do you think that they don't need to have something like this? I mean, some sort of way to enforce these kinds of things, like if there are complaints?
Well, they have had a lot of ordinance to enforce those things. And they say that this will replace all of those. But the ordinances that they're, now you might not remember this, but when they suspended the enforcement of camping in public places based on Martin versus Boise. You might recall that they said, but that's okay because we're going to enforce all those other ordinances. It's still the same kind of thing. So they still have those, and maybe eventually those will go away, but they're still on the books. We have rules about bicycles on sidewalks and dogs on leashes and noise around noise, and there's no sit, no lie, no pee. You know, there's shopping cart ordinances, and there's panhandling and aggressive panhandling, and all those things are things that have come into play since the gathering and the conglomeration of people out there. And there needs to be some way of to the city of Eureka's credit, they've tried to do a lot of things to work with their CSET team and with the MIST team and trying to find people and get them into housing. They've created a foundation that's able to vie for grant money and to fund projects like Uplift and LEAD. Those are all good things. The thing that is keeping people from using them, though, is that they center the police right in the middle. And for a lot of people that have been maligned by the system, traumatized, or who have history that has been unpleasant or have been told they can't participate. Like, there's a lot of people who don't go to the services like free meal now because they've been told they can't once upon a time, and they just, it's not a, you know, there's tensions. So having some alternatives, many alternatives are needed. And when we were talking about doing tiny house villages, that idea was used in Betty's Village.
Yeah, over on Coster Street.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So it demonstrates that alternatives are possible. But beyond that, there needs to be even more alternatives that allow for the people that are going to be engaged by it to have some voice in having a part of of what it is or how it happens. And that's never happened.
Yeah, I remember, you know, when I was going down to the Palco Marsh, you know, when that was a hot topic here in Eureka, and just talking to some of the people who were living down there, and getting a very different perspective where, you know, a lot of them were not interested in being housed traditionally. They were disillusioned by the deal of, I don't know, America that had been laid before them. And they're just like, yeah, I'm not really interested in playing by this set of rules. You know, what else you got, you know?
Well, and there are some really good examples of people who don't live inside easily. You know, usually anyone who's been institutionalized, it could be through mental health, it could be in the military, it could be for a lot of reasons, they just have issues about going inside. A lot of veterans have a lot of issues about going inside.
I was like, I hear you, man. I just, you know, it's this world as presented can oftentimes seem like the best option.
Well, the other part of that, Andrew, and I think this is really, really important, we are struggling with the destruction of our planet. We are living so hard on the planet, and we are personally pushing people who are living fairly lightly on the planet really hard. If we supported the need for, you know, facilities and garbage removal and those kinds of things, it would be, honestly, not the accumulation that people keep having so much disdain over. Because they do, if they had the ability to remain in place, they would reuse things until they couldn't even hold together in any part.
Oh, I remember when I went down there and saw, you know, because a lot of those camps were so established, you know, they'd been in the same place for, you know, a year, and, you know, they just had, you know, they had fences. I remember one guy's solar system. The solar panel, panel system that he'd set up to power his camp. I was like, well, this is quite industrious. He'd come up with an amazing solution to a problem.
I have watched people with, and today, you know, people that we are very closely affiliated with, make light out of almost nothing and so simple. And it's just in the process of life itself and not hurting anybody, not creating any problems. You know, we haven't even explored. My thought is, you know, when it gets down and dirty and we don't have the resources that we typically rely on, there's a brain trust there, and there's a level of skill and ability that we haven't even honored or tapped into or appreciated. And a lot of that has to do with really just wanting to live simply, not wanting to have all of the things that are creating our major systems problems now.
I hear that. So we're a year into this COVID horribleness now, and I think as with most things, the community whose voice is maybe most underrepresented is our local homeless population, as far as what problems they're experiencing. You know, what have you heard and what have you seen as far as how the conditions of this pandemic are uniquely affecting that group of people?
Well, actually, there are some cases in the homeless population now. I heard in a meeting this morning, and they did close St. Vincent de Paul for a couple of weeks because someone tested positive.
I heard about that.
But overall, people have been faring pretty well. There have been, I have some folks that I communicated with that work with CDC and Doctors Without Borders, and, you know, using all the protocols and the CDC guidelines and trying to see what works and what doesn't work. There's been a lot of information that's come out about, you know, congregate living and shelters being congregate situations and trying to chill that out and cases coming, you know, worrying about cases coming out of that situation. And that has happened in some places. So that people are outside, we hear people talking like we do from the beginning now. Is that you meet people where they are. You don't ask them to move about. But when we have ordinances that move them about and don't let them be in place, it's really hard to be able to you know, let people be safe and be where they are. And you know, the policing around all this, it's really challenging because you have situations that need to be taken care of, you know, and there are congregate situations with encampments that are here and in Humboldt County. There are people who are out there that are just in their own little pods that have been in their own little pods and stuck together for a long time.
I mean, you say a few cases have been identified in the local homeless population. Is that a current thing, or is that something or is that something to worry about now?
No, I think that's current. I think that's the St. Vincent de Paul.
And how long ago was that? The same
2 weeks. Okay. Two to three weeks. But it might be, I mean, we should anticipate that it's going to be there because COVID, you know, doesn't play favorites. It's everywhere. And it doesn't take much to get exposed, you know, as we know now. Yeah. So.
Actually, I feel like I should ask you if you know a little bit about it, because I don't think I've read the story anywhere. You talk about the St. Vincent having to shut down operations for a little bit because of there being a case of.
It was a letter. I learned about it from a letter that went out to groups that support folks who are houseless. Mm-hmm. And everything was, you know, somebody was tested positive. They were quarantined. Everybody was quarantined. 60 people or so who might have been exposed were tested. And everybody was tested again to make sure that it was negative.
When you got this message, was part of the purpose to also let other organizations, nonprofits know to kind of be able to step up and help a little bit? And what did AHA, respond?
I think that everybody wants to do a good thing. Everybody wants everybody to be safe. So the extension of that is how everybody's going to be safe is with vaccines. Are the vaccines coming? How are they going to get to people? How are they going to get to the houseless people? That's part of the discussion. Like, okay, it's a real thing. Now let's do the planning for how we're going to work with that, and everybody will participate as much as possible.
So you were talking a little bit about this idea of meeting people where they're at, and saying that now there's a lot of focus on that with other programs, which is something that that AHA has been focused on for a while. Like, one of the things that you do is the mobile showers, and that's kind of is that idea, right? That you come to where people are and offer the showers. I mean, I thought you could just talk a little bit about first just how that program works. And
sure. Well, when COVID hit, one of the things that we recognized was it was getting really hard for us to communicate because we couldn't go be in a meeting. We couldn't go do this. We couldn't go do the things that we typically do, you know, the shelter in place orders. So Zoom started and everybody started talking that way, but that wasn't feasible for folks that were out there. So we got a grant and we put a cell phone system out there with cell phones and chargers north to south, because our showers go north to south from southern Humboldt to northern Humboldt. And we gave phones to people and we loaded the phones with all kinds of links for services and support and getting current information about what's happening with COVID, the COVID protocols, here's how you do, here's who you call, to be in touch with their advocates. We put their advocates' numbers on there. We put, you know, the numbers of their local resource center and, you know, their contacts in their areas. And then we asked them to be in touch with us at least once a week and let us know how things were going. That was a beautiful dream, and it worked really well for how extensive it was. We put out 26 cell phones, which just doesn't seem like very much, but they were in significantly different communities. And so we were able to get information on how people were faring. A lot of people were able to get into the room key program. I don't know if you know what that is, where they're putting people up in motels if they meet the CDC criteria of being vulnerable. So they have to be over 65, have some kind of a health condition, you know, that would make them more vulnerable to COVID. And so a lot of people are in motel rooms now, just kind of waiting out, if the money holds up, waiting out the pandemic. There is also Project House Key, Home Key, which is to take money coming from the state and implement projects that will actually focus on getting people into housing permanently. That's kind of gone. That was very quick. It had to be spent by the end of the year, basically. But there've been different programs, and we've been able to share information about, you know, the COVID protocols, what's happening, and they become part of a system of distribution of resources that we've been able to support and be part of. And so there was a COVID-19 response coalition that formed. There was more grant money that came. We got sleeping bags and tarps and tents and gave them to people so they could shelter in place. But there was that disconnect of, you know, people, the sheriffs and people moving them out of where they were. So it was 6 one way, half a dozen the other. Phones got lost, phones got crushed, phones got stolen. But we still have phones out there, and we're still able to, you know, like I got a call this morning from one of the Eureka phones, just as an update of what's happening on that for that particular person and the people that they're in contact with. We talked to people down in Southern Humboldt, because we're going down to Southern Humboldt for the shower program on Sunday, just to let people know we're coming down, please pass the word. And Redwoods Rural down there posts flyers, and we work with a nonprofit show down there. And also they have a behavioral health specialist that comes out and is part of the caravan when we're there. So we try to make those kinds of relationships wherever we go. So the showers in McKinleyville, for example, on Saturdays, the second and the third Saturdays of the month, they have a meal there every Saturday, and they have volunteers that there was a recent article, I think it was in North Coast Journal, about Johnny Calkin's mom, who was making the lunch there for Saturdays for folks for a long time. And she's 95, and she's still making the soup. Our showers involve people in the communities where we serve. Okay. So when we're in Southern Humboldt, the Southern Humboldt folks are there providing, you know, some food and clothing, and we're doing the caravan with hygiene products, and the Redwoods Rural has their behavioral health person there. And in Eureka, it's largely volunteer, but we have a hairstylist that comes every other week, and you know, various times other organizations that come that want to just see what it's like and be part of it for a minute to see how it operates. But it's free, and it has all the amenities that somebody needs. We have intake and referral, where people can get information about things that they need. They can ask us, and we can refer them. Sometimes that's getting on the phone and calling for them and helping to make a connection. We have hygiene products that they can take away with them, and it's a wide array of things just to address personal needs. And then they can get a bagged or boxed lunch, some non-perishable foods to take away. They can also get a full set of clothing head to toe, jackets, hats, gloves in this kind of weather. Sometimes we have rain gear, but not always. And then they can have a hot shower, and they get 20 minutes in the room, 10 minutes of hot water. And then if they take a shower, they can get a haircut.
It's a lot more. The mobile showers are a lot more than a shower.
We call it the mobile, the caravan and pop-up care center.
Wow. Okay.
Mobile showers and pop-up care center. And the people who are our guests there are really in need of support. And they're very gracious. Most people are really just so pleasant and happy.
And it sounds like you're pretty hands-on with the shower itself. If you're
we've had a couple of drivers. One who's compromised because of COVID, so he had to stop. And then we got another driver who, same thing. He became ill and had to stop. So since last October, I've been the driver.
Okay, and you're driving the shower.
Among many other things, but we just hired another driver. So I'm really looking forward to getting back to a lot of the discussion around housing alternatives.
Okay. Yeah. Well, something we often bring up in these chats is the fact that, you know, because of the pandemic, it seems like there are a lot of people who are cooped up with extra energy to expend, people who might be looking for something positive they can direct their time to. Is there work being done surrounding local homelessness, whether it be AHA related or not, where people could donate themselves to lend a hand?
Yeah, you know, that was a big thrust at the beginning of COVID where a lot of people were making masks and donating them. Masks are always going to be needed. You know, we got a grant and we provide N95 masks for our volunteers and that kind of thing. But we bought NIOSH, the paper masks that work really well. And we teach people how to do it appropriately so they can close off all the air holes. Mm-hmm. And those are good, but they don't last a long time. So people would rather have, you know, masks that they can wash and rewear. But we are always giving out a lot of masks.
Okay,
that's
great.
So if somebody wants to make masks and
keep making masks.
And, and where, if somebody makes masks and wants to donate them, how will they can they go about that?
They could give us a call. They could call our office, 298-1466. That's the AHA office. We're located at the Labor Temple in Eureka, and we can make arrangements to the building technically is closed, but we are there often, but we can make arrangements to receive donations or to pick them up if necessary. And that would be just by calling and working something out with us. And other things, we're always getting things that need to be laundered. Somebody wants to do some laundry, that would be helpful. You know, I know that's kind of a logistical thing, having to get the laundry and then do the laundry and pick the laundry up. But that is, you know, we do have, we get donations and we request that people, you know, give us laundered items. But sometimes they come in and they need a little more than what, you know, they have at the moment. So right. I suppose that's a thing. Hygiene products, if people have been traveling and they have leftover things, you know, we hate the idea of having to use a lot of containers, but the reality is that there are a lot of them out there. And so if you have been shopping and stuffing and been traveling and stuffing your, you know, hotel goodies in a box somewhere, shampoo, conditioner, those kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good, clear out that medicine cabinet of all the, you know, old hotel shampoos that you have and donate.
Are you
those.
Supposed to collect those? I don't know.
Somehow I always seem to have a few of them. I'm like, I haven't even been to a hotel in years. Where did these come from?
Well, we just got a donation from someone who retired recently that did a lot of traveling. And so it filled up our hygiene bins. It was great.
Wow.
Okay. Nice. Yeah. Oh, and for the, you know, if somebody who's looking for services, can you kind of give a plug to maybe like the times of?
Well, we're always doing a clothing drive. We go through a lot of clothing and we try to actually direct people where they can, you know, get their clothes washed or whatever. But the mobile shower has more men than women typically, and we need men's pants sizes 28 to 38 only. We don't need bigger pants. We don't need smaller pants. That's pretty much the range, the range that we have. And for women, it's small. It's sizes 2 to 8 for the most part, maybe 10. And there are some who would like larger sizes, but we have a lot of that. So long sleeve shirts, hoodies, jackets, long johns, leggings, those kinds of things right now are really things that people could use. Yeah. Knit hats for men. We have lots of knit hats that we've been given, but they have like a little something sparkly on it. Or
well, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. If people want to volunteer or get involved with the caravan, they could fill out a volunteer form on our website. It's you can submit it electronically. We'll follow up and we'll contact you. And if you find a way that you would like to participate, we'll have you fill out a waiver and read some of our material and come and observe.
Okay.
Great.
If you want to use the showers, we have lots of people that volunteer for us that are shower users as well. And we are in Eureka every Tuesday, under the Samoa Bridge off Waterfront Drive by the boat launch.
Yeah.
And we start at 9 o'clock in the morning. So you have to get there early because it's first come, first serve. Okay. And we always have many more people who want to take showers than we have the ability to provide for there, because there's a lot of people in Eureka. Sure. Yeah. We're hoping to get a second site in Eureka at some point to be able to offer showers at the other end of town. We're out, you know, this is pretty far north in town. Yeah. We are in Southern Humboldt the last Sunday of the month, every month, we didn't do it this month because it was such terrible weather. So we postponed it to this Sunday. So we'll be down in Southern Humboldt this Sunday and then again at the end of the month. And we're in Arcata the second and the fourth Thursdays in the Transit Center parking lot. It is across from Arcata House Partnership. We start there at 11. We start signing up at 11 and we're usually there till about 2 or 2:30. Mm-hmm. And then in McKinleyville, it's the second and the third Saturdays. And we start there also at 11. And are there till about 1:30 or 2.
Great. Thank you.
We also have a liaison program. Folks from the houseless community that work with us that we are able to pay a stipend for assisting us with getting a reach into the community that we can't do. The people helping each other with getting their unemployment, their stimulus checks, getting in touch with their providers, transporting paperwork that needs to be filled out, just keeping people informed and helping us get the supplies and things that we and food out to folks that are out there. So there's one of our liaisons waiting for me at the office right now. So
okay. We'll let you go join them.
We will let you go. Is there anything else that you want to say, a last message to the
I really appreciate the invitation to come here and do this with you. Like I said, it's a new thing. I do get interviewed periodically, but this is new. So I appreciate that you're doing this and giving me the opportunity to share about AHA. And we pushed really hard to become a nonprofit when they started pushing hard to push people out of the Palco Marsh. And we wanted to be ready for that. We submitted a proposal as a nonprofit to set up 3 sanctuary camps of 30 to 50 people per camp, so they would have some place to go. And that didn't work because the proposal was for May 3rd and they evicted them on May 2nd. So we've not stopped wanting to create alternatives, and we will continue. We will have some tiny home villages and some really lovely communities that will just be busy, always busy.
Always busy. Yeah.
As you weighed affordable homeless housing alternatives.
Yes, Andrew. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll see you soon.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much.
All right. Nezzy Wade, we'd like to thank her for her willingness to jump into yet another Zoom, but her first podcast.
Yeah, that's fun. I'm excited.
I wonder how many people. What percentage do you think of our guests has this been their first podcast?
I would actually say probably at least half of them.
I'm gonna go 90%.
Well, yeah.
I don't have actual statistics on this, so none of it matters.
Yeah, thank you again to Desi. And if you're looking to help out, you can donate masks, you can donate toiletries, you can donate clothes. You surely have at least some of those things that you don't need. So. How about some other folks?
Yeah, pants, also men's pants. I clued into the men's pants.
Yes, well, you are a man who possesses pants, I assume, so.
Too many pants. Anyway.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thanks for joining us. Be good, be safe, wear a mask, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.